want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the subscribers who support this program. Eileen Weber just renewed for another year. Thanks, Eileen. Plus Nancy Mrazek, Lauren Howard, and John Dickerson. You can join that group. All the information is linked from my homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, filmmaker Sam Banning is going to talk about California's three strikes law and voters approved some reforms on November 6th that make it a little bit easier to take. But first, we're going to check in with Andy Worthington and get the latest on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the American gulag.
This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road.
Andy Worthington returns to our program today, the world's leading journalist who has focused on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He's the author of the Guantanamo Files and continues to maintain the website at andyworthington.co.uk. Andy, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you for asking me, Peter. It's great to be talking to you again.
Well, we've been distracted by the quadrennial presidential race. $6 billion in total was spent on all levels of elections in this country. Not a whole lot changed, but there is some relief here that the worst of the evils did not materialize in the form of a Mitt Romney presidency. And I have to say that the issue that you have covered in such a dedicated manner barely came up at all in the presidential campaign this year. The only reference I heard was in October. President Obama appeared on the Jon Stewart Daily Show, and Stewart asked him questions that no corporate media journalist had asked during the campaign. And in one of his answers, as he was trying to deflect other issues, the president volunteered that he would still like to close Guantanamo. And I took a little bit of encouragement from that. There's still many obstacles, including leaders of his own party. But for him to be willing to articulate that in the heat of a very close campaign actually surprised me a bit.
Right. Well, you know, the first thing that I thought when you said that was, well, you know, George W. Bush in his second term kept saying that he wanted to close it as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's a little bit too cynical, Peter. You know, the fact that he mentioned it is a sign that, yes, you know, he is aware that, you know, that parts of the electorate, that parts of his supporters, that people that he may have lost as a result of his stance, not just on Guantanamo, but on other issues over the last 4 years, mm-hmm. do still care. That there are people in public in some ways, in protest groups and various organizations, but also behind the scenes there are people, you know, trying to put pressure on the Obama administration, on his team, who have been doing that for 4 years. To get him to fulfill the promise that he made in 2009 and then couldn't complete.
Yeah. Well, and the record is mixed, but credit where credit is due. The president did authorize the release of 71 prisoners at Guantanamo since January of 2009. And many of those people were placed in other nations because they couldn't go to their home nation, either for our political reasons or because they were persona non grata in their native countries. And so there's, you know, some measure there that the particularly in the first year, when Greg Craig was the White House counsel, that there did seem to be a serious effort to reduce the population at the same time that the president sent a mixed message about long-term detention without trial and the resumption of these kangaroo court military tribunals. So the record is definitely very mixed. But I'd like to focus as we start out here on the 86 men who are at Guantanamo out of a total population of 166 or so right now. 86 who have been cleared for release by the Guantanamo Review Task Force. And this surfaced in September, and 55 of those people were actually named, which is a bit of a breakthrough, isn't it, Andy?
Well, it is, yeah. You know, and the you know, part of the reason, and I think mostly we can accept this at face value, is that the names weren't released before is because the government was involved in negotiations with countries to try and find homes for them or whatever arrangements they were trying to come to. And the publicizing too much about what was going on could possibly have been counterproductive. So that finally the release of these names, you know, after all this time, because the lawyers representing the men in Guantanamo essentially are sworn to secrecy on everything, unless they're told that they're allowed to talk about things, and all of this remained classified. So it helps, you know, us to understand who the people are that the government doesn't want to hold. And of course, once we have names, then we're in the position to be able to put stories to them, just put faces to them, to try and help to publicize the stories of them. You know, the great disappointment, though, is that so many men that the United States government has said it doesn't want to carry on holding, that it wants to release, are still being held. You know, and I can't really emphasize sufficiently, Peter, I know you understand the meaning of this, but I can't emphasize sufficiently what it means to be holding people in an experimental prison that was set up for the indefinite detention of these men, where they have been through processes not just under the Obama administration, but under President Bush, where decisions were made at high levels by military officials, by, in the case of Obama's task force, representatives of all the government agencies and the intelligence agencies, that these people, the government did not want to hold these people anymore, and yet they're still held. Some of these men were first cleared for release in 2004 yeah. by the Bush administration. Now, that's only a handful, but we know that dozens and dozens of them were cleared for release in 2006 and 2007 by the Bush administration, and that all of them were cleared for release by the Obama administration during these reviews of their cases that took place internally in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you step back objectively and look at it, that's a complete disgrace. It is worse to me than a tyrannical regime that imprisons people arbitrarily, that indefinitely detains people, which is what these men are, but doesn't say that it has any kind of review processes. It just says, look, we're going to lock you up and throw away the key.
Yeah.
What is the point of having supposed processes in place to decide who to release and who not when nobody gets released? You know, that's pretty disgusting.
Well, and one case that we recently covered here with Jason Leopold is the sad ending for Adnan Latif. And
yeah.
he was one of those individuals, I believe it's 13 total, who were originally cleared for release by the Bush administration 8 years ago in 2004. And in September, with no end in sight, he expired, and there's no indication that he killed himself, although he had made previous suicide attempts, so I'm not ruling that out. But the physical evidence, and we await the autopsy has been completed. It's been released to the government in Yemen, where Latif is from, but so far it hasn't been released to the public. And so we don't know what they're going to report as the cause of his death. But clearly, after 8 years of this indefinite detention, and let me say, I know a number of prisoners who say, look, if you tell me how long I'm going to be there, I can cope with it.
Yeah.
But if it is endless, and I think that it will be permanent, that is a mind-blowing proposition that leaves you in a state of despair.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree, Peter. And, of course, it's very important to raise the case of Adnan Latif, which, you know, I mean, to give some credit to the mainstream media, which has not been as dogged in their pursuit of this story over the years as they should have been, that's probably to put it mildly in
yes.
most cases. You know, people did wake up to the story of what happened there. They were, you know, you could see that in news desks and newsrooms around the country, people were getting the story and going, like, who is this guy then? What's the backstory on him? Oh, what? He was cleared, and then he was cleared, and then he was cleared, and then he was cleared, and they never sent him home. You know, it looks bad. It is bad. You know, I'm hoping that, you know, as we are able to renew our calls for the closure of Guantanamo from those people who care, that, you know, we will all be holding Adnan Latif's death, you know, as something to say, please don't let this man's death have been in vain, at the very least. You know, let no other cleared prisoner die at Guantanamo in the same situation as this poor man. And the fact that he's a Yemeni, of course, Peter, is very significant, because mm-hmm. two-thirds of those cleared prisoners are Yemenis. And the single obstacle to their release, and I must say, you know, this is about President Obama. In other cases, Congress has provided a huge, huge obstacle to the release of prisoners. But in the case of the Yemenis, it followed the failed plane bomb by a Nigerian man called Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who's mm-hmm. been apparently recruited in Yemen, who was captured on Christmas Day 2009. As a result of his capture and this discovery that he'd apparently been recruited in Yemen, there was this huge uproar, mainly from Republicans and right-wing pundits, about, oh no, it's Yemen, we mustn't release anyone to Yemen from Guantanamo. And President Obama capitulated. It was one of those key moments when he capitulated to pressure, when he should have said, what do these guys in Guantanamo, some of whom at that point who had been cleared for 5 years, what do they have to do with this offshoot of al-Qaeda that has developed in recent years in Yemen? Nothing. If the offshoot of al-Qaeda in Yemen consisted of anybody that had any connection with Guantanamo, we know that there were some unfortunate incidents involving Saudis who were released who made their way to Yemen. But men who were cleared for release from Guantanamo from Yemen, for all of them to be told, you can't go home because you're from Yemen, and we regard Yemen as a dangerous country. We regard Yemen as what? A country full of terrorist sympathizers? None of you are going home. Now, that decision was made nearly 3 years ago, and only one man has been released from Yemen in the whole of that period. The rest of these people are effectively consigned to indefinite detention at Guantanamo, like Adnan Latif, perhaps until the day they die, because of their nationality and their nationality alone.
Now, Andy, let me ask you, with the benefit of your non-American perspective, to give our listeners some of that perspective, because you just very ably articulated the incoherent policy of the Obama administration related to those who are cleared for release but can't go home because they're from Yemen. And that is barely acknowledged by Americans. There's very little awareness of that. And likewise, we treat Yemen like a colony where we're conducting target practice. There have been 37 drone strikes authorized by the former CIA director, David Petraeus, in Yemen so far this year. 37.
Yeah.
This is a failed state where we did ease out Saleh, the previous dictator, and installed a new leader friendly to the Americans. But we bomb this country at will. We have no authorization whatsoever from the U.S. Congress, from the Yemeni government, from the United Nations to conduct these military operations.
Absolutely.
And on top of that, we snuffed out Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son.
Yeah.
Without any American process. There were no legal proceedings. There wasn't even an indictment. There hasn't even been a coherent media case made about the alleged law-breaking of Anwar al-Awlaki. He is linked to Abdulmutallab. He is linked to the guy who was sending ink cartridges to Jewish targets in Chicago. Linked. But there is no proof that he was a terrorist leader, at least none that has been made public to the American people.
No, the main thing about him seems to be that he was American, that he was a publicist, and that because of his facility with the English language, he was regarded as a threat. But anyway, you know, to put that aside for a moment, I mean, the bigger Yemeni issue, you have just explained it very, 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 very well, Peter, you know, and I think, sadly, a lot of the American people don't know or don't care about everything that you've explained. Now, in terms of the, you know, everything that you've explained has this knock-on effect on the Yemenis in Guantanamo, where they're apparently contaminated by the perception of Yemen in the corridors of power, that it's this, you know, untrustworthy country. Now, that's, you know, the analogy that I always try and use with my American friends when I explain this is imagine if somebody from California was released from the domestic prison system in the United States and committed a crime, and then the response to that was to say, well, okay, then nobody from California must ever be released from prison again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's simply not acceptable. But the problem, the reason that it's been able to arise, apart from, you know, the indifference of far too many people to the people in Guantanamo, you know, either because they're foreigners or because they're Muslims or because they were told they were the worst of the worst. The actual fundamental problem is that these people remain a unique experiment, a unique category of human beings deprived of their liberty in a way that nobody has experienced in the modern history of countries that claim to be civilized like ours do. Now, if you're a criminal suspect, then you are given a trial, usually quite soon after your apprehension, as soon as it's possible for that to be put together. And if you are found guilty, you're given a sentence and you're put in prison. If you're captured in wartime, and the nearest analogy to what we're talking about here is actually wartime, because most of these people were captured while the United States was at war and in countries where the United States was... No, that, even that's not true, but Afghanistan and Pakistan. So some people were captured in Afghanistan where the country was at war, many in Pakistan, across the border. So we're already straying from this wartime model. But these were not people who were held as prisoners of war. If they were soldiers engaged in combat against the United States, and many of them actually had been involved with the Taliban before 9/11 and didn't have anything to do with the United States until the United States invaded. But if they were soldiers, they've never been held as soldiers. And if you hold people as soldiers, you give them the rights of the Geneva Conventions, and you're allowed to hold them until the end of hostilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've never been able to say when is the end of hostilities, because they're not actually held on that basis. They're held still, essentially, as enemy combatants. And on that basis, apparently, because they're this unique category of human being who's been built up to be something more than human, but with no rights of a human being at all, it's apparently acceptable for people to be cleared for release and then not released simply because of where they come from. And that's, you know, that's part of the problem. And if we were to look at other people held and not released, it's the same thing. The same issue fundamentally is that these people have no rights, or their rights have to be defined by people who care about them, and they don't have any legal standing, because essentially they are still the same people deprived of any fundamental rights as human beings, which they were when the Bush administration set up this prison in the first place. So, you know, that's what's depressing, really. It shouldn't be acceptable to be holding people that you said you didn't want to hold for years and years and years on any basis. It just really shouldn't be acceptable at all. It makes a mockery of any pretense of justice and fairness.
Well, Andy, I see you on Facebook quite a bit, and recently I put up a link, I shared a link to your article, which detailed the names of the men listed by our government as cleared for release in September.
Yeah.
And I, with the post, I said, are you embarrassed? I said, click like if you are embarrassed by America's continued arbitrary detention of these individuals. And, you know, I got a lot of Facebook friends. I get a lot of response. And on that one, there were only three or four people who clicked
right
on it. It really, it didn't surprise me, but it certainly did disappoint.
Well, it is disappointing, Peter, and you know as well as most people, you know, who know anything about my work, that one of the things I've been doing for all these years is to try and you know, unfortunately, to have to confront the American people with the reality of what has been done in their name by the government. And, you know, the best way to do that, of course, as with any injustice, is to understand that these are human beings, that they're not statistics, that they're not people who can be brushed away by Donald Rumsfeld lying through his teeth and saying they're the worst of the worst when he didn't know who they were. You know, human beings who have been wronged by the injustices perpetrated by your own government, you know, recognizing that is something that a lot of people find hard. It's a little bit too close for comfort. And I understand that. But, you know, my purpose throughout all this has never been to say to the American people, I hold you personally responsible. It's to say, you know, this is what your government has been doing. I think that if you have a heart and if you care about the law and you care about justice, then, you know, you should be fighting for the rights of these men to be treated fairly. But, you know, people find it difficult. And unfortunately, you know, I haven't really, you know, had much support from the mainstream media in people picking up on what I'm doing and saying, actually, yeah, this is important.
Mm-hmm.
This long-standing injustice needs to be exposed. And to do that, we need to, you know, we need to humanize the people who have been dehumanized. And that's the situation we're still in, Peter. And unfortunately, as time goes on, you know, and Guantanamo has significantly fallen off the radar, then it becomes more difficult to persuade people to remember this thing that you know, they seem to be happily engaged in forgetting in so many cases.
Yeah. Andy, one of the things that you've done a great job in keeping tabs on is the status of various court proceedings, primarily habeas corpus writs, brought on behalf of those who continue to languish at Guantanamo despite having been cleared for release. And the sorry state of affairs is that virtually all of these writs are being rejected when they reach the appeals court in Washington, D.C. One of the panelists there is a former Supreme Court justice from California named Janice Rogers Brown.
Oh.
And she is an architect of this darkness. I mean, her rulings are extreme and very deferential to the executive branch. So give us a quick sketch of the status of habeas, and then I'd like to talk about the recent court ruling that was favorable related to Salim Hamdan.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, just briefly, you know, there was a long legal struggle throughout the Bush administration to get habeas corpus rights for the prisoners. They got them in 2004. They were taken away. They got them again in 2008. And that was particularly significant because the ball started rolling then for their habeas corpus petitions to the district court in the District of Columbia to ask the government to show evidence to justify why they were being held and for the judge to impartially examine that evidence to ascertain whether the government had established a case at all, that these people were in any sense, in any meaningful sense, associated with Al-Qaeda and or the Taliban. You know, and it was extraordinary in those first 18 months or so, Peter, because judges were examining what they were given by the government, what they were given by the prisoners, and were making these calls in so many cases, saying, you know, to the government, you know, you're calling this evidence. This isn't evidence. This doesn't stand up. This is a collection of unreliable statements made by people that you have officials who have noted how unreliable these people are. This is hearsay. This is hearsay filtered through various levels. This is evidence produced from people who were tortured, evidence from people, information from people who were tortured, who were otherwise coerced. It was extraordinary. And the appeals court eventually, with a handful of these people, like Judge Janice Rogers Brown, but also Judge Kavanaugh is one particular instance, Judge Silberman, and others, pushed back and reached the point, actually in the case of Adnan Latif, the man who died. He had his habeas petition granted, and it was taken away by the appeals court when a panel of judges, the majority of the panel of judges, said, you have to give the presumption of accuracy to everything that the government puts forward as evidence because, you know, these were dangerous times and these are potentially dangerous people. This is propaganda. This is not justice. But they rewrote the rules. And from July 2010, actually, when up to then dozens of the prisoners had their habeas petitions granted and the majority of those were released, not a single prisoner has won since then. It's reached the point where the instructions the appeal court gave to the lower court tied the lower court's hands so much that every opinion that comes before them, they have to turn down. And, you know, the sad coda to this story is that in June, a number of these men petitioned the Supreme Court to address their cases, one of them being Adnan Latif, the man who died in September, and the Supreme Court turned away, would not consider a single case. The decisions on what basis people are held at Guantanamo, and bear in mind how shoddy all this evidence was exposed as, this information masquerading as evidence. The decisions are now left in the hand of a bunch of untrustworthy right-wing ideologues in the appeals court, in the D.C. Circuit Court, and that's how it stands. And that's a great shame and disgrace.
Well, it certainly is, and one of the things that is really difficult to accept is that we have trial court judges who are saying there is no evidence to hold this man, and then on appeal, they are simply bulldozed not by any presentation of facts to the contrary, but just by this incredible deference to the executive branch. And there we have to fault the Obama administration once again for demanding that deference. And the aggressive way that they have approached the courts to, on the one hand, deny rights to these human beings who deserve fundamental human rights, and at the same time denying any investigation or prosecution of those responsible for their fate, for their treatment, including torture, and that amounts to obstruction of justice, in my view. And so this is another unfortunate indictment of the Obama Holder Justice Department, which has failed in its obligation to uphold the human rights and the fundamental rights of these individuals that we're holding indefinitely, and at the same time refusing to hold accountable those who, in my view, clearly committed crimes.
Well, absolutely, and you know, and there is obviously you know, from a very high level, there has been an active decision not to proceed with any avenue of that could lead to the prosecution of a single individual responsible for any of the terrible things in the torture program that happened under the Bush administration.
Well, the only exception I can add there is John Kiriakou, the CIA guy who tried to blow the whistle on illegal torture procedures and ended up, because of the way they prosecuted him, pleading guilty to a single charge and denying us a trial in that case that would have led to discovery of some of the evidence that should lead to further prosecutions of the actual people involved in the torture, not the guy who exposed it.
Absolutely, Peter. Yeah, it's very grimly ironic, isn't it? You know, with Guantanamo, the Justice Department, I have to say, you know, there's a specific division within the Justice Department that's been dealing with the Guantanamo habeas cases. And those career officials, essentially, who always had a lot of influence under the Bush administration, stayed the same. So, you know, I don't know how deliberate it was that decisions weren't made to intervene, or how much it was just not considered that significant. But, you know, when on the one hand you had the task force that was making decisions about who should be held and who should be tried and who should be released, and there was no communication with the Justice Department. The Justice Department carried on pursuing every habeas petition as though you know, the life of Americans depended on making sure that not a single person was released from Guantanamo for any reason. Even though, you know, in the early days they'd been laughed out of court by judges, even by judges appointed by George W. Bush, who couldn't believe some of the cases that were coming before them. So we've reached a depressing situation whereby, you know, there is a responsibility there for the ongoing detention of prisoners that involves the Justice Department and involves somebody, whether this is at Eric Holder's level or at President Obama's level, not doing anything about the fact that this machinery is still ongoing and still designed to hold prisoners in Guantanamo even when another branch of the government has thoroughly examined their cases and said that there's no good reason to hold them. So they're being played with. Men's lives are being played with. And again, to get back to Adnan Latif, what happens at the end of all these cynical games that are all used for various types of political maneuvering is that people die in Guantanamo who shouldn't have been there. And that's not a good thing. That really is not a good thing. And, you know, and historically, I think that, you know, it will be noticed. It will be analyzed eventually, all the mistakes that took place, all the terrible injustices that took place. And that's just part of them. You know, you're mentioning the whole torture story, there are a lot of parts to this story. But on the everyday level of people still being detained when they shouldn't be, and being treated as though their detention was some kind of a political game, mm-hmm. You know, Guantanamo is a place to look at because that's where it's still happening.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Republicans who were still burrowed in there at the Justice Department. Obama hasn't replaced many of the U.S. attorneys who are, there are 92 of them, I think, or 94 prosecutors across the country. And it is standard procedure that when a new president takes office, all of those people resign and he gets to appoint his own.
Right.
And now we're into a second term where Patrick Fitzgerald, where some of the people in Alabama who prosecuted Don Siegelman and others remain in their posts. And it's just mind-boggling to see that continue. The only kind of Machiavellian theory I can have is that they want to be able to bust those people if these bad policies are somehow exposed and linked to the president, that they need a fall guy or gal. But after 4 years, that kind of a theory wears thin. Andy, let me next turn to the decision of October 16 by a panel of judges at the D.C. Circuit Court related to Salim Hamdan. And his name has been attached to previous Supreme Court rulings. But this was significant because it blew out of the water the charge of material support, because it was something that was created out of whole cloth by the Bush legal teams. And the court found that his conviction had to be thrown out because there was no standard. There wasn't even a definition for material support, much less any status of it being a crime.
Yeah, it was really extraordinary. You know, I was absolutely blown away by it. This is Judge Kavanaugh. He's one of the judges, you know, who has been handing down these very dubious decisions in the D.C. Circuit Court about the Guantanamo prisoners when their habeas petitions are involved. But in this case, as sometimes happens, and, you know, I'm always impressed when it happens, you know, this is a panel of judges that looked at the law, that on this occasion didn't allow their political feelings to color the decision that they made. They stepped back, they looked at the law as it stood and said, you had no basis for the prosecution of this man. You know, it throws the credibility of the military commission system, what tattered credibility it had, I think it blows that out of the water completely now. It remains to be seen whether there will be any attempt made to do anything about it, other than, you know, to carry on with a handful of cases of people who can significantly be accused of recognized war crimes. All the little fish that have been caught up in the military commission system to date, it basically, you know, they're off the hook as far as trials are concerned. Now, whether there's, you know, any prospect of them being released, of course, is another matter tied into what we were discussing earlier, essentially. But, yeah, it definitely does that because, you know, most of the people who've been convicted to date, most in a lot of cases, you know, a major part, if not the whole part, as in Salim Hamdan's case, it was supposed to be material support for terrorism that was the basis of their conviction. The other strand that Hamdan's was thrown out, actually, but some other prisoners were convicted or it was part of their plea deal, was conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
Which also looks quite dubious as well, although, There's another appeal going on at the moment. But I think just that what's happened with material support, if this stays as it is, it demolishes the possibility of there being many trials in future. And actually, just talking to you now, Peter, has made me aware, well, what happens to these guys then? Because there's a whole bunch of people that were supposed to be put forward for trials.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that many of these people were so insignificant that it was the only thing that was, you know, that was making it even plausible that a trial could be held. Not credible, but, you know, that there was any machinery to do it, was that this category of providing material support for terrorism was supposed to be the thing that would nail them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, you know, that what needs looking into is the limbo that these men were in. Because, you know, part of the problem is that we mentioned those 55 names of prisoners cleared for release that was issued by the government back in September. They haven't ever officially stated who are the three dozen or so prisoners to face trials. Now, we know that, you know, about a dozen of these people are or have been tried.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of dozen of people that were designated for trials by the task force but haven't been named. And there are, you know, at current estimates, I think about 46 other prisoners that the task force recommended should be detained indefinitely but not put on trial because there wasn't sufficient evidence. Now, that's an alarming situation to be endorsing at any official level. But, you know, we kind of could do with exploring these stories as well. But obviously the first thing I think that any of us who really care about Guantanamo can do is to keep pushing this message that over half the men there have been cleared, which is what, you know, we've been doing all year.
Right.
And we'll be rallying again to do on the 11th anniversary of the prison's opening in January.
Andy, just going back a moment, you referred to conspiracy issues. Is that a conspiracy to provide material support? So is it linked to this most recent Hamdan decision? Or is that separate from material support, just conspiracy as a general notion?
Well, it's conspiracy to be involved and commit various acts with prescribed organizations is how I understand how it's been used.
Uh-huh.
The reason that I don't know how it's going to go is that, you know, there have been credible sources on both sides of the argument saying either that it could survive an appeal process, and others saying that it might not. The government senior lawyers, Jay Johnson, the senior lawyer at the Pentagon, was one of several senior figures who told Congress that material support shouldn't be included in the new military commissions in 2009, but Congress ignored them. Now, you know, he also in his testimony suggested that the conspiracy charge looked more robust. But like I say, there have been other people with considerable expertise looking at it and saying this doesn't look any more credible than the material support charge. So.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. I mean, if conspiracy goes as well, then, you know, then the whole thing is gone. You know, what it should lead to is the end of these ridiculous military commission trials that are moving at a glacial pace at Guantanamo for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the other co-accused for the 9/11 attacks, and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they should go to the federal courts where, you know, the Obama administration almost exactly 3 years ago said it wanted to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other men in federal court for the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah.
And then backed down on that when faced with a tidal wave of criticism. So I think it's up in the air again, Peter, to be honest.
Yeah. Now, I want to come back to that issue of trying in federal courts. But first, again, with the benefit of your non-American perspective, how do people in Britain and other places that you're in touch with view the show trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Because it's pretty clear to me, I don't think you have to be completely cynical, to see that this surfaced in time for the election process. And now it's back on a very slow track after there were a couple of news stories that surfaced, of course, very close to the anniversary of September 11th. And during the final weeks of the presidential campaign.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I think some of that's deliberate. I think some of it is just the slow maneuvering of the machinery of the commissions, where a hearing takes place, then there are then months go by while there are deliberations about various points regarding how things are going to proceed. The judge has to analyze certain things and make decisions. So some of it, you know, probably wasn't even timed cynically. It was just this lumbering glacial movement of the cases, because, you know, there are significant complaints from the defense teams about the way that these things are being conducted, which is that, you know, their clients been gagged from the moment that they arrived at Guantanamo, that not a single word that any of the high-value detainees has uttered to their lawyers has been allowed to be made public. Nothing. Now, you know, the whole Guantanamo setup is such that every word between the prisoners and their lawyers is presumptively classified. But in the case of all but the high-value detainees, or maybe some other prisoners, but in general what's happened over the years is that when the lawyers have then submitted the notes of their meetings to the Pentagon Censorship Board to see what can be allowed to be released to the public and what can't, you know, a significant amount of information has been unclassified. In the cases of the high-value detainees, nothing, not a single word. Why? Because they want to talk about their experiences in the black sites and what was done to them, as well as, presumably, the lies that they told while they were being tortured. But, you know, the U.S. government wants to keep an absolute lid on it. Now, I don't really see how the trials can proceed on that basis at all, even functionally. I don't mean this isn't a credibility issue. This is just, I don't see how we can actually have something that can pretend to be a trial while these people are gagged. But, you know, that's the big issue. I think when people look at it, that's what they see. I don't think that really, you know, I don't think that really most people are looking at it any more closely than that, Peter, to have discussions about, you know, is this system completely discredited? Should these be federal court trials? You know, there are issues amongst the people who understand when you put the word Muslim and terrorism together and put people in a U.S. federal court, you're not looking at a system, at a situation that is very conducive to justice. You know, the conviction rate when Muslims accused of terrorism are tried in federal courts in the United States is very close to 100%. Now, you know, that's not accurate. So, you know, and of course the United States justice system has these horrible, disproportionate sentences for people, whereby, you know, the system is actually, you know, composed largely of plea deals, where people can guarantee that they will leave, well, that they're liable to leave prison alive, you know, by entering a deal. So, you know, the whole thing is fraught with problems, but...
Well, and you were kind enough...
I'm kind of with Eric Holder that when he was interviewed shortly after the announcement of the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial, the 9/11 trial in November 2009, he said, you know, this is the most important case of our lives. This is how history will judge us. You know, and then he had the rug pulled out from under him, and he had to back the military commissions.
Yeah. And your reference a moment ago, you were diplomatic enough not to mention how the domestic terrorism cases are almost to a total, involving provocateurs, infiltrators who set up the guy, and then, you know, when it's time to pull the trigger or detonate the bomb, they're exposed as having been entrapped. And that isn't justice either. But, Andy,
no.
Returning to the issue of trying these people in federal courts, we have now the anomaly of al-Masri, who your country finally served up and allowed to be extradited. This is the Finsbury Mosque imam with no hands. And he is being tried in federal court in Manhattan. And
yeah.
And nobody in the United States is pointing out the bitter irony that the show trials continue at Guantanamo after we were told that you can't allow this to occur in a federal court. And yet, that's exactly what they're doing in the al-Masri case.
Well, you know why that is, though, Peter. It's because if you use the words Muslim and terrorism, you're allowed to try them in federal court. If you use the words Muslim and terrorism in Guantanamo, you're not allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it. Now, that is not there is no justifiable legal position for that to be true, but that is the truth. You know, hysteria has been stoked very cynically in various parts of the United States establishment and the media to make sure that if you add the word Guantanamo to that mix, you know, you have to keep these people out. And I mean, you know, there is one man who was sent from Guantanamo to be tried successfully in the United States mainland. You know, you may remember the case of Ahmed Khalfan Gailani, a Tanzanian accused of involvement, convicted of peripheral involvement in the 1998 U.S. embassy attacks in Africa.
Right.
You know, and that was dreadful the way that that was played by the right wing. You know, that the federal court system failed because the jury, you know, saw that this man was a peripheral figure and only allowed him to be convicted on one charge out of the hundreds of which he was put forward for trial. But that was still sufficient for this man to get a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, he seems to me to be a peripheral bad guy in a very terrible thing that happened 14 years ago, and justice was long overdone. But, you know, I think objectively it can be said the system worked here, prosecuting somebody from Guantanamo accused of terrorism. But, you know, that's kind of been wiped out of history, that case, because, mm-hmm. You know, then lawmakers intervened to make sure that no other prisoner could be brought to the federal court system from Guantanamo. They legislated to prevent it.
Yeah. Stoking fear and hysteria. Finally,
yes.
Andy, I'd like to ask you to just give us a quick update on the last British prisoner held at Guantanamo Bay, and that is Shaker Amer.
Well, what can I tell you, really, Peter? You know, Shaker Amer's name is on the list of the 55 people cleared for release by the Obama administration's task force in 2009. Now, his lawyers knew that. It was kind of common knowledge amongst campaigners that was his status, but it had never been officially acknowledged by the U.S. government. You know, it hadn't for any of these 55 men. So you know, to have that confirmation rather begs the question: so why is this man not back in South London reunited with his family? Because every obstacle that has been imposed to prevent the release of any other prisoners. Either that, you know, legitimately they can't go home and that somewhere else has to take them in, or that, you know, the senators foaming at the mouths have decided that, you know, this country, that country, this other country are all too dangerous to release people to and have put huge obstacles in the way. This is clearly not true of the United Kingdom. There is no way that all but, you know, the most rabid of lawmakers would suggest that Britain is not a safe country for a prisoner to be released to. So, why is he not home? I don't know, Peter. Every day I ask that question. There are politicians working on his case here in the UK. There has recently been some mention that he could be released now that the election is over. He needs to be released. I mean, I'm sure that the discussions that are taking place to break the deadlock, whereby I do think that President Obama will want to be releasing some of these people. He should be top of the list. I just don't know why it hasn't happened already.
Well, I want to invite people to visit your website, andyworthington.co.uk, and also closeguantanamo.org. And as soon as I hang up with you, Andy, I'm going to sign up here and add my name to the petition here and to the list of supporters of that group. And let's be in touch in January to observe the sorry anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo.
Absolutely. It would be great to talk again. It's been very, very good to talk to you tonight, Peter. Excellent, as always. Very in-depth. And it's a topic that needs to be covered in-depth because it doesn't lend itself to sound bites.
Thank you, Andy. I appreciate your ongoing work on this.
Thank you, Peter.
In our November 6th election here in California, voters finally got rational about the draconian three strikes law. It's been amended, and we'll talk about the details with filmmaker Sam Banning.
I'm
One of the great documentaries screened at this year's 11th annual San Francisco Doc Fest is called Cruel and Unusual, and the filmmaker joins me now, Sam Banning. Hello, Sam. Welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hi, how are you?
Well, it's great to talk with you, and so many documentaries about crime and punishment are fighting for change that seems way down the road and often quite elusive. And I hate to steal the thunder here, because you've produced a powerful documentary about a problem that has been partially addressed by reforms that were put on the ballot by the group that you profiled at Stanford University. But we've seen a little bit of relief, at least for third strikers, under California's very extreme three strikes law. First of all, tell me how you feel that what almost 7 million voters and 68% of those who voted on Proposition 36 said, yes, let's amend the three strikes law.
Yeah, I think the victory for Prop 36 will resonate across the country, and it's really a positive step toward reducing excessive and irrational three-strike sentencing. And I think this is what the people really wanted. I don't think they wanted these life sentences for writing a bad check or shoplifting.
Yeah. Well, Sam, I have been crusading against this law since even before it was put on the ballot, as you show in your documentary. A gentleman from Fresno, California, who lost his daughter in a crime, decided to start a crusade. And his crusade was hijacked by preening political figures, including Governor Pete Wilson at the time, a guy named Michael Huffington, who is best known as the ex-husband of Ariana, who was running for the United States Senate and pumped money into the Three Strikes campaign.
Right.
And also the National Rifle Association.
That's right.
Which saw a boat that they could ride. And there's one more, and I'm a pro-labor guy, but the Prison Guards Union here in California is not as powerful as it used to be.
Right.
But in the 1990s, they were looking for any way to increase the prison population as a way to increase jobs for guards. And they supported Mike Reynolds' effort to pass a three strikes law. So that, coupled with the Polyclass kidnap murder case, created a kind of perfect storm for hysteria that lasted for 20 years.
That's right. I think the politics of fear played a key role in the passage in 1994 of three strikes. And that's right. The prison guard did spend about $100,000 for Mike Reynolds' 1994 initiative, and they spent $1 million to help defeat Prop 66 in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've supported and sponsored the Three Strikes Law since the inception.
Yeah. And I have sympathy for Mike Reynolds, but I don't agree with having victims dictate our criminal justice system and the penalties that accrue, particularly this senseless law that, in his view, was just going to sweep the streets. And if you've committed two crimes before, it doesn't matter in his mind what the third crime is. It's worth it to spend $50,000 a year to lock that person up.
Right. It's based on this notion that petty offenders will commit serious crimes in the future. So they're being punished for crimes they might commit in the future, which is a very radical notion of how to deal with repeat offenders, mm-hmm. in particular nonviolent offenders.
Well, and Sam, one of the things about the Mike Reynolds story that still sticks in my craw is that I followed this matter very carefully. And in 1995, before all these records were online, I got from the State Political Practices Commission a complete list of all the donors to the Three Strikes ballot measure. And one of the things that Mike Reynolds says is that, you know, he took his retirement money and his life savings in order to pass three strikes. Well, I learned from that he was completely reimbursed by the money that came from the prison guards and Huffington and the NRA. And so while it was narrowly true at the time that he used his personal funds to circulate the petitions and to help get it passed, it's not entirely accurate because, from what I can tell, he was made whole by the political interests that kind of took over the bandwagon that he got rolling.
Yeah, that's right. I think they spent about $1 million back in 1994 compared to, I think, around 30,000 in opposition mm-hmm. of the three strikes law.
Well, and the other thing that was going on at the time, I went around the state with Peter Sussman, who had recently retired as an editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. Mm-hmm. And we had a booklet with a dozen of these cases of three strikes criminals whose third strike was the pizza, the bicycle, stole a lamb chop to have for dinner.
Yeah.
And the other wave that was occurring at that time was the O.J. Simpson case. Mm-hmm. And the media was so caught up in, exploiting and hyping these criminal cases that it was very hard to have a rational conversation about these issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a great deal of crime hysteria that was taking place in California. And I think politicians did not want to seem too soft on crime at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, politicians have a strong desire to seem tough on crime. But I think Kamala Harris in California has created this new philosophy that we should be smart on crime. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where California needs to be heading.
Yeah. And about 10 years ago, I interviewed the pollster Mervyn Field, who runs, he's retired now, but he started the Field Poll, one of the most respected public opinion polls in the country. And at that point, people were still very much in favor of the three strikes law. And I asked him, if he had any prediction of when that would change. And he kind of shook his head and he said, well, all I can tell you is that right now, people are not prepared to be rational about crime. And to me, the exploitation on television news programs, in feature films, mm-hmm. creates the climate of fear that you referred to, Sam. And then we see, ambitious politicians, many who don't have a real moral compass, who just say, well, I'm going to create the illusion that I'm tough on crime and that, I'm like Wyatt Earp or pick your favorite cowboy sheriff. And I'm going to go out there and clean up this town. And there's a lot of mythology and very dangerous propaganda that is rolled up in those messages.
Yeah, and the prison guard union actually spends millions of dollars donating to political campaigns. So they do have a lot of clout in California politics and advocating for pro-incarceration policies.
They also fund a group called the Doris Tate Crime Victims Bureau. And I've gone to Sacramento to, advocate before the Public Safety Committee and others for sensible regulations related to crime and parole. And they will trot these people out on a moment's notice. And it's really sad because they have tragic stories that they tell.
Mm-hmm.
But they move from their own desire for revenge or, some sort of score settling into areas that they have no expertise on. And they will block, with tears and a recounting of their own sad story, any reasonable effort to reform the system and to stop the waste of huge amounts of taxpayer money to lock up people who aren't a threat to anyone.
Yeah, it's a huge waste of resources in California to spend money to keep a shoplifter in prison for life at a cost of $50,000 per year. That just doesn't make any rational economic sense. Not to mention the human, aspect of mm-hmm. keeping somebody in prison for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Committed a shoplifting charge and other theft-related charges in their past.
So, Sam, what made you an activist on this issue and caused you to use your skills as a filmmaker to create this documentary, Cruel and Unusual?
Well, I was really inspired by the human stories of individual injustice and also outsiders coming in to help these nonviolent three-strikers achieve their freedom. I think, the Stanford Three Strikes Project was very inspiring, and also the story of LaDoris Cordell, a judge in Santa Clara County, convincing a court to release a woman who forged a $140 check at a Nordstrom to be released in 2009.
And tell us that story about Kelly Turner. Take a moment or two to explain to our listeners how she got caught up in the three strikes law.
Well, in 1997 in Torrance County, she was caught forging a $140 check at a Nordstrom store. And she was sentenced to life in prison under California's three strikes law. And her sister talked to Montel Williams, who was devoting a program to the three strikes law, and she appeared on the show via telephone and told her story and was actually explaining that she was, you know, had a cellmate who was doing more time than her for a murder. And so, you know, it was just completely irrational, her life sentence. And LaDoris Cordell was on the Montel Williams show and heard her story and decided to go visit her in prison. Mm-hmm. And she said that she wanted to do something to try to get her out. And 2 years later, with the help of another attorney, they convinced the court to release her. And they found out that she actually only admitted one prior strike. And the prosecution portrayed her as this serial robber who had five strikes. And so this whole case was a complete miscarriage of justice. And now she is doing remarkably well. She's a public speaker. She's written a book. And she's settled down and she's married. And she's doing just great.
And, Sam, we have 58 counties here in California. That's 58 district attorneys. And there isn't a statewide standard. The Supreme Court did intervene, as I recall, it was about 2000 or 2001. And they did give prosecutors more discretion in terms of just ignoring previous strikes, so that they might bring a case that is a second strike instead of a third. And that discretion seemed to be well used in some liberal counties, like San Francisco and Santa Cruz. But in hardline counties like Orange County and some of the more rural counties with a bit more of a cowboy or redneck mentality,
right,
we saw the law very arbitrarily applied. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's very random the way it's applied from county to county. It really depends on who the DA is and what their ideology is. So in Kern County, they would strike out almost every eligible person. And also, a lot of the three-strike sentencing happened under Gil Garcetti in Los Angeles. So 40%, I think, of all three-strike cases went through Gil Garcetti in Los Angeles, mm-hmm, between 1994 and 2000 until Steve Cooley took office, who invoked a policy not to prosecute a case if the third strike was non-serious or non-violent.
Mm-hmm.
So then three-strike cases went down 40%.
Yeah.
And it didn't have an effect on, you know, reducing crime. You know, I mean, the three-strikes law actually has no effect in regards to decreasing crime.
And how do we establish that? Because, you know, these statistics are very hard to peg to, mm-hmm, social conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always argued that, particularly when it comes to violent crimes, that you can't put a rational frame around it. And, you know, does a guy who's ready to pull out a gun in a robbery or in, you know, the heat of a fight, does he sit back and think, oh, my gosh, this could be my third strike? We know that the decisions that are made in a situation that is later deemed to be a crime are usually very spur of the moment,
right,
based on emotional or adrenaline reactions. And so they really don't stop and say, oh, yeah, Mike Reynolds, he passed that three strikes law. I better not do this.
And especially in the early years of three strike, I think a lot of people didn't know that these misdemeanor crimes would even count as a third strike. So, you know, I think when we talked to Kelly, she didn't have any idea that, you know, this doing this would actually result in a possible three-strike case.
Mm-hmm.
Because these crimes are so minor, because a lot of these crimes that can give you a life sentence under the previous three-strikes law could be any felony, which can be really anything above jaywalking.
Yeah.
So a judge has discretion in those cases to sentence you from anything from probation to life imprisonment. So that disparity is, I think, beyond anything known in the criminal justice system.
Now, Sam, outside of your filmmaking, have you also been advocating for Prop 36 and for other changes in the criminal justice system?
Well, we're hoping this film can be used as an awareness-raising tool to shed light on the tremendous human, social, and economic costs of California's three strikes law. So we're hoping this film can be shown across the country to, you know, show, you know, different alternatives to reducing crime and sentencing laws in this country. So I think in a way this film can help to reform some policies in the country and scaling back our criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sam, I do enjoy listeners all over the country. So if people wanted to get in touch with you and get a copy of the film and maybe screen it for a community group or a church group, is that a possibility?
It will be in the future. We're setting up an official website. So Cruel and Unusual is the title of the film. So if you look that up, we'll have a website online shortly in the near future. And we're hoping to have a national broadcast in the future, too.
Now, I saw it was screened on the PBS TV station in San Diego.
Yes.
Have other PBS stations agreed to air it?
KQED has, and we're also hoping to speak with ITVS. They're looking at the film right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how did you pull this off? It's a very well-produced film. I don't imagine that you had a multi-million-dollar budget.
No, it was almost entirely self-financed with the help of a producer. And it cost about $60,000 to make, and we traveled the state. We went to Los Angeles about 11 times, and we live in San Francisco. And we went all across the state to, you know, the Central Valley, to Los Angeles. And it took about a year and a half to make.
Mm-hmm. And so, Sam, I am gratified that the voters did reform the most egregious part of the three strikes law. But it's still on the books, and I would love to see it ultimately repealed because it's completely unnecessary.
Right.
As you point out, one of the trigger cases was the Polyclast murder, and Richard Allen Davis was convicted for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he had prior convictions, and they didn't need the three strikes law to sentence him to, I guess he got the death penalty, right?
He did.
Yeah. And so there was no reason in his case to require a three strikes law. Do you think we'll ever reach the point where we can repeal it altogether?
Yeah, well, I think at some point we should. I think repealing the three strikes law, this law based on a slogan, which is this very broad-based approach, is not really appropriate for criminal justice policies in California. I think we should have alternatives to dealing with these nonviolent offenders. And I think Kamala Harris had a Back on Track program in San Francisco that dealt with these nonviolent offenders and put them through a program that costs $5,000 a year compared to spending $50,000 to put them in our prisons, which are, you know, essentially human warehouses that provide absolutely no rehabilitation.
Right.
So we need to think about different policies.
Well, and we have this skirmish between the state and a federal court, which has ordered a substantial reduction in the state prison population. And it's supposed to be reaching 110,000 by next summer. And the state has already said we're not going to make that goal and is essentially daring the judge to take further action against the state. Now, I do give them credit, and Governor Brown in particular came up with this realignment program where more convicts are serving their terms in county jails, and only the most serious and violent offenders are supposed to be sent to state prison. And the population peaked at over 160,000,
mm-hmm.
So getting it down to 130, 120, which is roughly where it is now, is a major achievement. But I am pained to see the state dragging its feet about the final steps to get down to the level demanded by the federal judge.
Yeah, and I think this doesn't affect any of the second and third strikers. And the second strikers are actually a whole other story. I think overall there's 41,000 three strikers in California,
mm-hmm.
which is four times the amount of the whole country combined under the three strikes law. So there's about 30,000 second strikers and majority of the second strikers committed a nonviolent second strike. So that's also a big part of the three strikes law that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Is the amount of nonviolent three strikers we have, second strikers we have in our prisons.
So, Sam, what are your plans regarding the film now that there has been this important reform approved by voters and some of the individuals sentenced to a third strike of a life top sentence will be going to court and hopefully getting some relief individually applied to their cases? But are you going to amend the film to reflect these changes?
We will. We will. We're making a post-election cut that should be feature length. And we're going to interview some nonviolent three strikers at San Quentin who will be eligible to be released. And it sounds like they should be released in about 6 months to 2 years. I think in some counties it may take even longer. But in Santa Clara County, I know the DA, Jeff Rosen, is very on top of the issue. And he will be, you know, paying close attention to all the nonviolent three strikers in his county who are eligible to be released and have a resentencing hearing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, I really appreciate what you've done here. And before we go, I just want to know if there's anything else you'd like to add or any other issues that you would like to connect to three strikes and reform of it.
Well, I think three strikes is really one aspect of a mass incarceration strategy that we have in California that directly affects millions of African Americans who have been locked up for long periods of time for nonviolent drug-related crimes. So this is a major problem that I think society really has to focus on.
Well, and unfortunately, it seems that the cost factors are what cause most people to reflect.
Right.
But I think that there is a fundamental human rights issue.
That's right.
Related to the way we treat people. And we've done programs in the past on the long-term solitary confinement that can extend for decades for individuals who are held at the so-called SHU at Pelican Bay State Prison in the northwest corner of the state. And that's not the only issue, but it is one of the most egregious that screams for some sort of reform.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we need to start reforming our criminal justice policies across the country that are more just and humane.
Well, Sam, thank you very much for the film, and thanks for joining us. And when you get that website up, why don't you send me an email?
Okay.
And I will update the listing for this podcast, and people will be able to access that and maybe see it on a screen near them or arrange for a screening in their community.
Great.
The fight for human rights at Guantanamo and here in the Gulag in California will continue. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until